Buddhism, dear friends, begins with an unexpected answer to a disarmingly simple question. To the question, what is life? Buddhism answers, life is suffering. Now, Buddhism and Judaism are fundamentally different. If one put to Judaism the question, what is life? We would perforce answer something to the effect that life is opportunity, a gracious gift of a gentle God. To be sure, there is suffering in life, tears, and heartache, and anguish, but equally, and to us more significantly, there are hopes that do come true, there are dreams that can be realized, there is real joy. In Judaism, then, building on this philosophic foundation, the central test of ethics is the judicious use of one's vigor. Teach us, O Lord, to number our days, that we may get us a heart of wisdom. The consecration of energy in worthwhile pursuit lies at the heart of Jewish commitment. However noble all this seems to us and reasonable, the Buddha would take exception to it. He would do so sweetly, dispassionately, for he was not a man to break a lance in bitter philosophic or religious argument. But despite the gentleness of his manner, he would not hide from us his diametrically opposed philosophic position. Time is not a challenge, but an enemy. Life is not opportunity, but unrelieved pain. The religious message must not be one of involvement in the service of mankind, but of estrangement, of escape, of disengagement from life itself. And if you spoke to the Buddha of man's instinctive zest for life, our desire when we are young and full of strength to plunge in and to be doing, would say to us, this is precisely why I have come, to tell you to staunch the thirst for that you have for life, to control your passion for life and your zest for living. Only that man that lives dispassionately, only the man who has cut all the fetters that bind himself to life, only such a man can know quietness and peace of mind and find salvation. Now, what led the Buddha to take such a jaundiced view of life? To see life not as an exciting adventure, but as a sweaty, miserable, enervating trek, which can lead to no profit, to no pleasure, to no peace of mind, only to constant agony and pain and suffering from which we can only pray and work for the relief of release. Some have tried to understand the Buddha by understanding those in our own age who seek to be in life, but not of life. We have these members of the cults of disengagement. In England, they are called the outsiders. We label them in the United States more prosaically the beatnik. And many of these people do indeed claim to be disciples of the Buddha, especially of a school of modern-day Buddhists called Zen. What leads these people to want to cut that which binds them to life? Some misapprehension bordering on anger at the quality of our standards, at the shoddy moral pretensions of our materialist society. In part, discouragement. Discouragement at the unwillingness of this materialist society to applaud the creation of their handiwork. And in part, a realization of the artificial nature of our life, of the hush-hush antiseptic convention and taboos with which we push out of our homes, off of the center of the stage of life, all that is painful, all that is anguishing, illness and senility, and age and death. These modern disciples of the cult of disengagement would have us look life squarely in the face, and this too was the Buddhist teaching. We ought not to misjudge the Buddha by the presumption of superficial similarity. For the Buddha was above all things a truth seeker, not a tea house sophisticate. He was a man of deep, profound faith, not one of our current faddists in philosophy. No, I think if we would understand the Buddha, pull aside the mists of 26 centuries, we had rather project ourselves back into his age than to seek to draw his life and his mental processes from our own. For it is not the material presumptions of our affluent society, but the cruelty, the naked brutality of life in 6th century BC India, which in part explains to us a religion based on the single truth that life in its entirety is suffering. The Buddha was born into an anguished, pain-racked land. The glaucoma eye, the extended belly, the palsied limb, these were the everyday occurrence, sight on the streets of the city. In India, there was malnutrition. Epidemic was prevalent. The stench of sewage and offal, sweat and of the funeral pyre could not be kept from one's nostrils. India's energies were sapped by premature childbearing and backbreaking labor. Life was raw, at its most naked. How is there joy? Another Hindu mystic asked. How is there joy, how is there laughter in a land that is burning? And India was burning with fever, the fever of disease, the fever of early death, the fever of grief, the fever of poverty, the fever of all the indignities of life. Now those who are raised in the slum often become immunized against the stark reality of the indignity of the slum. They grow up to accept it as part of the given of life. And very often it is the man who comes upon the ghastliness of slum living later in his life, in his development, who sees it at one blow, in all of its reality, in all of its grayness, in all of its pain. Often it is such a man whose life is most profoundly changed and affected by the sight of human poverty, and so it was with the Buddha. For Siddhartha Gautama, whom we call the Buddha, was born of a small, privileged, conquering class of India. He was the son of a princeling of Sakya, a little community north of Benares near Nepal in northern India. He was of the Aryan conquerors who had imposed their will and their taxes on the Dravidian masses. He was raised and coddled in the lap of luxury. High villa walls separated him from the sights and the sounds of the groaning, teeming masses. His life was well-mannered, his garden well-tended, his education well-attended to. But as he grew into young manhood, he came to realize that that which coursed outside the gates of his villa was the truth of life, and that which passed for life within the gates was its artifice. A deliberate masquerade, a closing of the eyes, all that was truth, fact, inescapable, ineluctable, in the destiny of man. A pious legend has it that on one day's chariot trip through the city streets of Sakya, he came in turn upon an elder whose limbs were shaking, whose mouth was frothing, who had no longer his memory or his mind. And upon a glassy-eyed, perfervid man, who could no longer control his body, who was racked by some burning disease. Finally, on a stone-cold, outstretched corpse being feasted upon by the insects and the carrion of the neighborhood, the sights and the sounds and the reality of life in India. And he did not see this senility, this sickness, the stench of death as part of the landscape, the local color, as might a tourist to modern India. But he looked upon the street and he saw this sight and he said, there am I. This is the truth of life. Despite my vitality, this is my age. Despite my vigor, this is my illness. Despite my youth, this is my death. This is part of the inevitable. I soon will be in that state. Now, if the Buddha had been born in the West, heir to another religious tradition, a citizen of another political order, he would have simply put off from himself the world of the cocktail and of the country club and taken on the world of community service and social reform. But in India, there were few agencies of social reform. The hot sun and the brutality of life had long since drained up, sponged up the juices of progress. India was resigned to its life. And those in India, from time immemorial, who came upon reality, death, disease, and poverty, and were affected by it, touched by it, sensitive to it, instead of committing themselves, as did the prophets of Israel, to establish justice, committed themselves to a wanderer's life, to the seeking of truth, to an immersing of themselves into poverty and misery, into the mass, and somehow with the beggar's staff in one hand and a mendicant's bowl in the other, by ascetic practice, by fasting, by mortifying the flesh, by yoga and by vigil, somehow to find within this seething mass some peace of mind, some message of truth. And so it was with the Buddha. At the age of 29, he kissed his wife goodbye and his son. He closed the door of his villa. He put aside his satin garments and took on the coarse rag of the monk. With a pair of sandals on his feet as his only other possession besides his beggar's bowl, he set out to be one of the thousands of wandering religious, seekers after peace, searchers for truth, who to this very day travel the byways and the highways of India in search of relief, release, rightness and of understanding. And for 6 years he mortified his flesh. He practiced the strictest discipline of self-control of yoga. He fasted endlessly. He performed 100 to 1,000 acts of simple goodness. He sought by the rigor of this discipline to find some peace. And he found no peace. For though others had found their salvation in such a regimen, this was denied to the Buddha. And finally, in one long, last, desperate vigil, seated in controlled rigidity for 7 days under a famous bodh tree, all the puzzled pieces of life suddenly fell into shape. Truth became his. Light illumined his mind. He became the Buddha, the enlightened one. He suddenly found that for which he had been so painfully seeking. And what did he find? What truth did he preach for the next 45 years of his life? This truth. The truth that begins with the imperative, be not a friend of the world. The world, he said, is an enemy. Life is a mirage. It can offer no real refreshment to the hungry traveler. But you say, there are joys, there is love, there is happiness, there are moments of bliss and of rapture. These are illusions, he would have said. These are snares, these are traps. For every moment of joy you pay in the end a terrible doubled and redoubled price. Today you are giddy with love. And tomorrow you are plunged into the abyss of grief and despair. Today you are wrapped up in the busyness of life, only tomorrow to have, by ill luck or ill chance, these wraps pulled from you and to be suffered the chilling cold of loss. Loss of status, loss of face, loss of wealth. Today you rejoice in your strength. And if you rejoice, you will suffer only tomorrow the long years of frustrated weakness. Our joys only trap us into greater hurt. He who would live without pain must learn to live without joy. Must learn to deny the zest for life, the desire to plunge oneself happily, eagerly into all that seems to be hopeful, to be coursing about us, to be of the essence of life itself. A great religious leader since time immemorial have taught us to be moderate in our ambitions, to measure our appetites, that it is a sin to be greedy and to be lustful. Thou shalt not covet, states our own Ten Commandments. For we know that a too precipitous, hasty, thoughtless commitment to life leads only to pain. That there is effort which is vain, which is purposeless. The search for fame, the search for wealth, the keeping up with the Joneses. All this is meaningless, it is trivial. So it has been taught. But let us be clear on this. The Buddha's teachings are much more far-reaching. For the Buddha asks us to clip from our lives not only the desire to be wealthy, to be of the 400, to be powerful, to be successful, but he asks us to clip, to cut with desperate surgery all the ties bind us to our fellow men. Ties of love between husbands. Ties of devotion between child. The ties of affection between father and son and mother. Involvement between man and his neighbor, man and his friend, man and his community. We take it for granted that the saying that no man is an island unto himself. Buddha insisted, make yourself an island. Our Bible commands, love thy neighbor as thyself. Buddha insisted, love neither thy neighbor nor thyself. Cut not out only one desire from your life, but cut off a whole forest of desires. Love not, hate not. Only a man who has cut through all these fetters can know peace. Buddha then is a religion of man in his aloneness. And as we read the Buddhist literature, we drink, we find your cord. All who have known bitter, desperate grief. All who have wanted to pull down the blinds of life, to shut out for a moment, even the solicitude of a friend, the comfort of a neighbor. All of us who have wanted at times only to be alone, to keep our own counsel, to be allowed the privacy of our own integrity. All those who have, us who have known such moments, sympathized, touched. Man his aloneness, and Buddhism as it developed into a religion, became not a religion of congregations, of assemblages of people, men and women, and schools of children, but was a religion directed to the man who became joined the Sangha community Buddhist monks. The homebody state and joined the community of homeless wandering men. Business and profession, ambition and appetite, only community, only such men and women can begin to find the enlightenment, the peace which Buddha preached. To what end did Buddha insist man must adopt this difficult discipline? The end of salvation in Buddhist teaching is nirvana. What is nirvana? To understand it, perhaps I ought to ask first another question. Why, feeling as he did that life was a burden, painful, suffering, why did Buddha not preach a doctrine of early suicide? Surely then we have cast off the suffering of life as quickly, as deliberately as we could. The answer is simple. In Indian metaphysics, of which the Buddha was heir, the grave is not the end. Now we too say the grave is not the end. Man, woman lives on beyond the grave in peace with God. But beyond the grave in Hindu metaphysics, there is no peace, only rebirth. We are born only to die. We die only to be born again. And if we are born again, we take upon ourselves again another life of suffering and pain and misery. Suicide, then, the premature ending of this suffering, only brings about a premature taking on of another life of suffering. Suicide, then, to the Buddha could be no answer. What was his salvation for man, for the monk, for the individual? Life is a continuous chain, birth and death and rebirth. Man must somehow unlink his section of that chain, separate himself from the movement of life, and find quietness and rest. Now the monk who has attained enlightenment, who has staunched up his zest for life, who no longer is thirsty for life, who has cut all the ties that bind him to life, he knows peace of mind, peace of body. He is at peace. He has excised himself from the wheel of life. And having done so in this life, he need no longer fear rebirth. When he dies, that is the end, nirvana, peace. Now, obviously, we in the West cannot accept the piety and the principle of this metaphysics. The Buddhist salvation is not one that we seek. What is it in Buddhism that appeals to us? In part, the largest part, the poetry of human emotion. In part, in great part, Buddhist ethic. Buddhists preached an eightfold way, related into our life, we might say. This way consists of self-control, keeping one's own counsel, taking life as it is, without rose-colored glasses, practicing a diet which controls our lives, a discipline by which we prevent ourselves any excess of body, of mind, of mouth, of hand. Study, training, confrontation, right mindfulness, concentration. These are the techniques of Buddhist ethics. And to a world which is restless as ours is restless, which is full of frenetic activity, much of it meaningless, purposeless, without goal, as our life is, Buddha's insistence that actions be deliberate, that we not be precipitate in what we do, but that we confront life, take life as it is, understand the facts before we commit ourselves, that we are at peace except when energy is imperative, this too has great appeal. But ultimately, however much we applaud and we approve, however much we find greatness and depth in this faith, we must say that if we followed it out logically, it would lead us to a world of anarchic individualism. Indeed, it would force upon us a life which would be the very reversal of all that the Buddha taught. For the man who seeks to excise himself from life, who says, I will not be a part of the society, who asks only that society fill every morning his mendicant's bowl, is essentially a selfish man. He thinks of himself as selfish. He is selfless. Home, car, wealth, love, all these things are meaningful. But he asks this of the society, that it support him, whatever be the level of its support. And he asks the society of this, to allow him to withdraw his energy, to withdraw his talents, though the society might desperately need these of him. In our day, we might simply say that the monk, if there is war, will be cindered along with all else. That in a day which desperately needs men of heart and men of spirit, men of religious commitment, these men are precisely those who must be part of life, who must give us counsel, who must give us guidance and leadership. And they cannot ask us for the luxury of withdrawal, of disengagement and of escape because we cannot afford it. Buddha then presents to us a noble ideal, an ideal of self-control, which all of us might take to heart. But beyond that, we might hope that this ideal of self-control be infused with the imperative of the prophet. Be deliberate in what you do, yes. Be determined, yes. But determined not to escape, not to cut the fetters, but to tie yourself more closely to that which is worthwhile in life. But when all is said and done, life is not suffering. It is a tabla rasa, a blackboard empty of writing upon which we can write great poetry or filth. A cipher or a sum? Depends on us. It is an opportunity. The gift, as Judaism does teach, of a gracious God. Amen.